people she's ever met, that she's a light, and she, their family would not have been the same without putting her in. And I think that's amazing. And I would like you to give her a warm welcome. Jane.
All right, let me put this down here. Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Jane, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jane. We love you, Jane. Lots and lots and lots.
Thank you. I love you guys, too. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's so cool to be at a young people's convention. It was so funny when Ashley, thank you for asking me, Ashley, when Ashley invited me, I was kind of like, wait a minute, you want me to speak at a young people's convention? It's almost like getting proofed when you're buying alcohol or buying a pack of cigarettes or something, you know? But what an honor and privilege it is to be here in your midst tonight. I'm so happy to have been asked, and what an honor it always is to, you know, get requested to share your story at a great group like this. And oh my gosh, are you guys ready to get this weekend started or what? Woo! I'm telling you, I can tell. I mean, the fun vibe is in the air, and you know, I can remember when I used to dance on tables. You know what I mean? It's been a long time. I might get this weekend. We'll see. but anyway, I want to first start out by thanking a bunch of people. I already thanked Ashley, but I can't thank you enough. It's so funny. I had never been to Iowa before a couple of months ago, and I went to AIM for Ames and met a bunch of really cool people, and sure enough, I'm back to get to know all you young people, and I love Iowa. I could tell you that right now. It's really been great. And yeah. And I want to thank my friend Jane for picking me up at the airport and letting me crash at her fabulous pad last night. Thanks, Jane. And I want to thank my host, Dawn, for her caring correspondence. And really the whole committee. You guys have done, oh my gosh, it just started, but what a great job you've done so far. I love that entrance. That was cool. Who else do I have to thank you to the sound? I mean, that's pretty cool. I should have given you a list of things to play throughout my story because, you know, the soundtrack of my, you know, but thank you so much for everything that you're doing, for recording too, you know. I mean, let me tell you something. I don't know what I would have done without recordings early in my sobriety. I'm one of those alcoholics that lost my license, like, for a lifetime, you know? So in early sobriety, I really, you know, valued the stories. And to this day, I love popping them in when we're taking a road trip or something. So my sobriety date is September 24th of 1996. Probably older than a lot of you. I've been sober longer than a lot of you have been born, right? Like, I'm sure I'm seeing some young faces under 27 years old here. And as was stated, I'm from the great state of New Jersey. I really wanted, you know, I stood up for Florida because that's where I live now, but I really wanted to stand up for Jersey because I am a Jersey girl through and through, you know? I grew up in, it's like a suburb of Manhattan. It's about a half hour west of the George Washington Bridge. But I love being a Jersey girl, and I'm sure you'll hear all about it in my story that I'm about to tell. But anyway, I always love starting out by just saying, you know, one of the greatest lessons that I've learned in sobriety, really, is that I've learned to live in the here and now. And isn't it a beautiful place to live? You know, I know that all my fears are kept at bay when I learn to live in the now, when I have learned to live in the now. And I really just wanted to start out by saying it. You know, I'm right here, right now. Everything is okay. And what a gift that is. You know, we're housed, we're fed, we've, you know, we're having a good time, and just never forget that. And I wish somebody pounded that into my head in early sobriety. And also, I just looking out at the crowd, I just feel so blessed. And, you know, if you're a newcomer, this is an amazing way of life. It's a great design for living. And I feel like, you know, if we practice the principles of the program, it's just a great way to live our lives. And so I am asked here tonight because I'm supposed to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. So I'm going to step right into doing that now. As I mentioned, I'm from Jersey. I come from a big Irish Catholic family. My parents have 7 kids. You know, we grew up knowing God, loving God, praying every night, going to Mass every Sunday. We were like the family that took up the whole pew in Mass every Sunday, you know. And really, I had a wonderful upbringing. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And my dad was, you know, really kind of a strict guy. It's from that generation. By the way, I'm 61 now. And this is so cool. I am going home next week on Tuesday. It's my mother's 89th birthday. And on Thursday, it's my father's 93rd birthday. And they still live in the house that we grew up in New Jersey. So how lucky and how blessed am I? So let me tell you a little bit about my dad, because it says a lot about how I was raised. So my dad is really well known in the world of track and field. He was actually favored to be the first person ever to break the 4-minute mile. And he just missed it. He ran a 4.00.02. Can you imagine? And I always like to share this story. He was, like the New York Times does an article every year on the 10 most exciting moments in Madison Square Garden. And one of them involved my dad. And so this night, Madison Square Garden was full because back in the day, track and field events were like a big draw. And I remember all the pictures. You can see like Joe DiMaggio's there and, you know, Rocky Graziano's there by the finish line. It was like supposed to be this epic, epic event. Somebody was going to break the 4-minute mile that night. So anyway, exciting race. They get down to the final lap. Actually, get down to the final runway, and my dad was in second place, and he went to overtake the guy who was in first, and when he went to pass him, the guy elbowed him off the track on the inside. He was on the inside, so when you step into that inside circle, it's an automatic disqualification. Well, my dad hopped back on the track, grabbed the guy by the back of his shorts, spun him around, and they had a fight. Meanwhile, the guy who was in third went on to break the world record. He didn't break the 4-minute mile, but he broke the world record. But that just says so much about my dad. He's just like this feisty, you know, doesn't take any crap from anyone. And his father was a boxer from Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, urban legend has it that as soon as the race was over, you heard my grandfather yell out, "Now take him out back, Freddie, and finish him off," you know? So that's just a little bit about my dad. He had so much, you know, discipline, focus, hard work ethic, you know, and I think, and by the way, he went on to not only be a great runner, but also a great track and field coach. He brought Little Manhattan College to an NCAA championship back in the 70s. So anyway... that's the guy who raised me, okay? And all of us kids, we all have this tremendous work ethic. You know, you play hard, well, you know, by golly, you still show up and, you know, honor your commitments kind of thing. So anyway, I went to Catholic schools. I went to a Catholic elementary school. I actually even went to an all-girl Catholic high school. Anybody else experience that trip? No? Oh, okay. But anyway, I graduated in 1981, and there were 81 girls in my class. And I always like to share this because I think it's just a fun fact, and I loved her dearly, and sadly, this disease took her down and took her down hard. But one of my closest friends in high school was Whitney Houston. And we had like 81 girls in my class, and yeah, we were all pretty tight. And most of us really went on to make something of ourselves, you know? Especially Whitney, for goodness sake. but anyway, high school was just, I have really fond memories of high school. I was, you know, on the student council, track club, but also just involved in everything. If I had to explain myself, really, I was kind of like the all-American kid. I was a late bloomer when it comes to drinking and drugging. But I graduated second in my high school class, and I had grand aspirations when I went to college of being like a doctor or a lawyer or something that made a lot of money, you know? And I went to where my dad coached. I went to Manhattan College in New York City, and this was in the 1980s, and it was almost like the sheltered Catholic schoolgirl let loose in the biggest, baddest city on earth. And I went wild. You know, I was actually pre-med freshman year. By the time I got to my second semester, I changed to English literature and creative writing. let me tell you something. And Manhattan College is the last stop on the one train. So Manhattan is open 24/7, so I had access to that city, and I hit it all the time. I had a severe case of FOMO, you guys. I mean, way before I got addicted to the substances, I was addicted to the social life. And, you know, back in the 80s, this was the days of Studio 54, the Limelight, the Peppermint Lounge. One of my claims to fame is I saw the Ramones and the Talking Heads at CBGB's, you know, Rosa. I mean, I was out there and I was doing it. And I love drinking, and I know that we're not supposed to have an opinion on outside issues, but I have one. I absolutely love them. I love some cocaine and I love some marijuana. But I always, always had a drink in my hand. You know what I mean? And like those other things kind of helped me to drink longer and harder and faster. And yeah. So don't you all wish kind of that we had like a record of our ATM, withdrawals? Oh, man. So anyway, so I had all of my dreams. Okay. First of all, sometimes I always sing this during like my regular talk when I'm with older people. So it might be lost on you all, but you heard of the Eagles, right? Okay, well, I was living life in the fast lane, everything all the time, life in the fast lane. That was what I was. And all of my dreams, all of my hopes, all of my aspirations went into the back seat of that car. And, I was driving down that highway going 99, believe me. And so I always jammed at midterms and finals, and I did okay. But I'll tell you something. By junior year, I was tired. And so I had the opportunity to study abroad. So I went over, and I had a series of geographic changes, okay? But this was my first big one. I remember, okay, New York is really, I got to get out of here for a while. I didn't even pick Paris. I was going to minor in French. I didn't want to go to Paris because I heard everyone spoke English there. I went to a little city called Nantes. And I'll tell you something, I tore that city up at just as bad as I was tearing up New York. I lived with a family who had a 19-year-old nanny, and we were, she was just as crazy as I was. And thank God that was pass-fail, because I just passed. But then I had a great time. Actually, that summer, I was able to backpack through Europe, which was one of the greatest events of my life. I had such a great time. The biggest lesson I learned when I was backpacking through Europe was we magnetize party people, don't we? Like, man, we know each other, you know? And so I had, okay, here's my priorities. I had $300. I had the plane or the train ticket, which the Eurail pass can get you anywhere in Europe. So I already had that paid off. Then I had $300 extra. So here's where my priorities were. First stop, Amsterdam. Okay, so I could, like, load up for my magical mystery tour. And second stop, London. Now, this was 1984, new wave, punk rock. So the last $150 I got my hair cut in London. And you should have seen this. This is one of those where I would queue up some, like, I don't know, flock of seagulls or something, you know? But I mean, I had, like, hot pink hair before it was even fashionable, shaved up one side, big white shoots coming out the front. I mean, oh, my God. And then I just counted on, like, sleeping on beaches, on park benches, or people taking us in their home, whatever. I mean, but anyway, and I had the greatest time. You know how, like, when you're sharing your story, sometimes people in AA will say stuff like, oh, Jane, you just think you were having a great time. It's like, no, I was having a great time, I tell you. Oh, my God. So then I got back to New York senior year. Same thing. I said, okay, I'm going back. Now I'm really going to straighten out my act. Forget about it. I started dating the biggest Coke dealer on campus. You know, and let me tell you something. I always had, like, this innocent-looking face. I could talk my way into or out of a brown paper bag. I did it with cops all the time. I mean, I did it with my professors. I did it with, you know, family friends who were worried about me, whatever. And so I got away with a lot of stuff. And I talked myself into getting a great job right out of college. I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of Hoboken, but it's right across the river from Manhattan. And all the people who can't afford to live in Manhattan live in Hoboken. And it has the Guinness World Book record of having the most amount of bars within 1 square mile. I'm not kidding. I mean, it's like Bar City. And so, so I got a job teaching high school English and French. And I got a job, of course, in the evenings at an Irish pub. And I'll tell you something. I don't know how I did what I did. Well, let me correct that. Yes, I do. I had some substances to help me through. But I remember the days would turn into nights. The nights would turn into days. I remember, you know, driving. I would be like, because that work ethic I told you about earlier, I would be the one at like 7 in the morning, still wide awake, still partying, everybody else going, oh, man, I got to call in sick. I'd be like, okay, I'm going home. I'm taking a shower, and I got to head to work. And I would do it, you know. So I tell you that just because, I don't know, like I was able to handle stuff for a long time, for years, actually. I taught high school for 3 years. You want to hear, this is like just a cool aside story. A couple of weeks ago, I got an instant message on Facebook, and it was somebody who said, hi, you might think this is really weird, but I was listening to like a podcast online AA story, and I think you were my high school teacher. And so sure enough, I was her high school teacher. I got back with her, and she invited me to share at her home group on Zoom. So it was really kind of a trip. I hadn't seen her in like 40 years, you know, but she said some really nice things. I said, you know, I hope I know I was wild back then. She's like, oh, yeah, you were pretty wild. But you know what? You were one of the best English teachers I ever had. So it made me feel, she made me feel kind of good. But I was even crazy when I was teaching high school. I mean, I would drive to work in the morning, like with my rock and roll blast and smoking cigarettes. I would always have this big thing of vodka and cranberry, right? Because vodka doesn't smell. Yeah, right. And I would go to school, and at lunchtime I would hit it, and then right after school. But all my morals started to decline when I was teaching high school. All those lines that I said I would never cross, slowly but surely I started to cross. I started having an affair with a married teacher. Like, I think I was 21, and he was like 38. And he was going through a midlife crisis, too. I mean, do you guys remember overhead projectors? Yeah. You know what we used to do on them? Yeah, that's what we used them for. Uh-huh. And we'd be... So anyway, yeah. So, gosh, I hope all these years later I can't get arrested for talking about this stuff. But anyway, that's what it was. And let me tell you, risk-taking is a big part of my story, too. I don't know how many of you can relate to that, but if I had to put, like, me in a nutshell in my younger years, it would be I was like a hell-raising, risk-taking, rule-breaking, rock and roll, woo, give me a dare, I'll follow, I'll do it, you know, chick. I wanted to live that rock and roll lifestyle, and I went to great lengths to do that, you know. As a matter of fact, you name the band, I saw them in Madison Square Garden, and I actually partied with a bunch of them, too, you know. So anyway, I was living a great party and lifestyle for many, many years before things turned, is what I'm trying to say. But I'll tell you something. My family started having talks with me, stopped inviting me to family functions. I don't know how you reacted, because I'm sure all of you went through that with your families, too. But what it did to me, when they made me feel like crap or like a black sheep, it would be like, oh, yeah, you think I'm that bad? Watch this. And I would, like, go out, and I would do something really self-harmful go do a one-night stand or what, just something that was self-harmful, put it that way. And, and speaking of, like, one-night stands, you know, that kind of became, like, my self-esteem was so low that, like, that would be one of my big challenges. Like, I would scope out a guy at a bar, and I would be like, okay, because I didn't think I was, you know, pretty enough or whatever. I knew I was funny, and I knew I was obnoxious and, you know, crazy. So that would be like a challenge to me. So let me see if I can get this guy. And then after I would lasso him in, well, you know, I had to throw him a crumb, right? You know, like, you know how it goes, right? And then it would be like I'd have these semi-consensual experiences that, you know, would just make me feel terrible, filled with guilt and shame, and I would feel so bad the next morning that the only thing that would dilute those feelings would be to pick up a drink and just start it all over again. And that became my cycle, you know what I mean? So anyway, then I had, after I lost my high school teaching job, go figure, I had another geographic change. A guy who I taught high school with said, Jane, you got to get out of here, and you need to go far, far away. And I did. I had to get away from that guy. I had to get away from the alcohol and the drugs. I had to get away from my family. So he recommended, I'll tell the story. I rarely tell this one, but so he said, you know what I did? I went over to Japan. I had a sabbatical. I went over to Japan, and I taught English for a year, and you should do that. And I was like, that sounds great. And he said, okay, well, the guy, the interviewer, is coming to New York. He's going to be interviewing for 2 days. He's going to all the big cities in the U.S., you know, Los Angeles, Chicago. I don't think he came to Iowa. Only kidding. And so anyway, I went on my interview, and when I opened the door, it was this good-looking English guy. And so I did the interview, and after the interview, I was like, hey, by the way, have you been in, you know, have you hung out in New York? I mean, he said, no, it's been, you know, just crazy with all these interviews and stuff. And I said, well, how about, you know, we go out tonight, I'll show you some really cool places. So we did, got wasted. I got the job. Woo! And honestly, 3 weeks later, I was on a plane to Japan. Can you believe that? And I remember, getting onto the plane was a whole other story. You know, back then, you could sneak stuff on, no problems, right? So I remember sitting next to this guy, and he's like, "Oh, my God, you're moving to Japan. Do you speak any Japanese?" I was like, I know how to say domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. That's about it. That's all I know. Those of you who left, I'm pretty impressed that you know who the Sticks band is. Okay, good. And Japan, it was just, I'm going to stop my, what I was like. You get the drift, right? But Japan is where I crossed another line. I thought, I don't know anybody over here except for that guy. And he lived in Tokyo and I lived in Nagoya, so I knew nobody. I hooked up with the craziest bunch of Australians and New Zealanders and Canadians and Irish and Scottish and woo! And let me tell you something. We would have gotten arrested weekly pulling some of the shenanigans that we pulled over there. Japan is a really easy place to live as a functioning alcoholic. I worked for Toyota mainly, and I had to go stay in the Toyota Training Center for a month. And my students were Japanese businessmen who were about to be shipped overseas. So they had to be immersed in English. So I ended up having to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner with them. And every night we went out drinking. You know, just think, if you're a Japanese businessman and they tell you, your company says you have to go move into this place, speak no Japanese, only English for a month, and then you're getting shipped overseas. They were like, "Oh, my God." And so then they get into the class, and they see me. At this time, I was like this 25-year-old, whoop-bee-bop into the room. They were like, "Oh, yeah, this is going to be fun." And so it was for them a vacation out of their regimented Japanese business person lifestyle. So they had the time of their lives, and so did I. But I'll tell you why I'm telling you this is another line that I crossed. That is when I knew I needed a drink first thing when I woke up in the morning. I was shaken. I needed a drink to just get right. I couldn't wait to get to my room at lunchtime to get fixed up to bring me through till 5 o'clock, and then it was on at 5 o'clock. And I went to Japan for a year. I ended up staying for 3. It was so easy to live like that over there, you know? Okay, so let's move on. So what happened? I moved back to the U.S., and instead of my family being like, "Oh, she's back," they were like, "Oh, God, she's back," you know? I hadn't changed at all. As a matter of fact, I took it to a whole new level. And I got my first DUI within a week of return. Yeah. So, my mother was just like, "That's it. I can't take it anymore. You know, I'm disowning you, you know, whatever." And she really meant it. And I was like, "Okay, fine. I'm moving again. I'm out of here." And my brothers and sister kind of like just stayed out of it, you know, but they knew I was a mess. And so I said, "Okay, another geographic change. Jersey, done. I'm out of here." And this is how I ended up down in Florida. So a friend of mine had a restaurant and said, "Why don't you come down here? You can waitress, hostess, whatever." And I kid you not, I had this firm resolve. I am going to straighten out my act. I'm moving to Florida. Nobody knows who I am once again. And guess where I moved? Now, I hope you get the reference here, because it's kind of insane that I thought I was going to get, you know, straighten up here. I moved down to the Florida Keys. So that experiment was a complete disaster. And in the Florida Keys is where I hit that incomprehensible demoralization that we all read about. That waitressing job was, it didn't last too long. And I literally became homeless within 2 weeks. And I was, you know, every once in a while I would sleep on the beach or I would crash on someone's couch. But I called these months were like my fade to black months. You know, I had lost the desire to really live. And I didn't have the courage to take my own life. But let me tell you something. I wanted to die. And I remembered like walking around barefoot with a bottle of Popov vodka in my hand at all times. Forget about snorting cocaine. I was smoking crack. I mean, it was like, yeah, it was like I was either gonna like have my heart explode or like drink myself to death like Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas. You know what I mean? I just, yeah. And that lasted for like for months. And I remember having the proverbial look in the mirror and seeing like this skeleton. And I had the wherewithal to call a cousin of mine, and she came and picked me up. She lived up in Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, the kindness of others is how we've gotten through some of the stuff that we got through. I didn't know this cousin very well, and she had four kids under 6 years old. And lets her, like, you know, dying cousin move in. And, you know, anyway, I really did try and get my act together. And, but it didn't take long before I was back on, you know, a similar path. And, yeah, so I got a job temping. And I remember it was for Delta Dream Vacations. And I met a guy who was living in Europe at the time. He was living in Austria. And he was putting together vacation packages that he was trying to sell to Delta. And I remember this guy, we went on our first date, we went skydiving, right? That risk-taking thing, it never left me. And I was so wasted when I went skydiving, too. I mean, I think of, how many of you can relate to this? Like, I should have been dead, like, over 100 times with the stuff that I did. And I'm not exaggerating, at least. By the way, my drinking and drugging run lasted 14 years. When I think of all the times that I should have been dead, ugh. But that was one of them. I mean, you know, I was so wasted. I wasn't really paying that much attention to when I pull the thing. I remember being in the air, like, screaming and like, oh, I guess I got to pull that thing now. You know, I mean, just crazy. It was just insane. So, but anyway, yeah, he was really adventuresome and, you know, just like I was. He was really well-traveled. He was a really cool dude. So anyway, this one weekend, he had this idea that he wanted to go down to the Florida Keys to check out the water sports. And I was like, oh, man, the Keys is where I really hit the skids. Okay, let's go, right? So off we went. We go down to the Florida Keys. First tiki bar we hit, I went in and we had a bunch of drinks. And we did that all the way down to the, you know, down the Keys. And there was this bridge. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called the 7 Mile Bridge. And it's where that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, True Lies, you know, they blow that bridge up at the end. Well, I remember we had, you know, we went out and partying and drinking and all that, and we went and watched the sunset, and we went out drinking and partying again, and we said, oh, let's go down and watch the sun come up. So off we go. You know, we got a bag of weed, a case of beer, some vodka for shots, and I remember this time I saw a sign that said authorized vehicles only, right? And I was like, oh, well, vehicles, you know, let's go. And we went down this road. It was the old bridge road. And unbeknownst to me, they had just blown that bridge road up for the movie, for True Lies. And they had a concrete barrier put up. And I went around a small curve, and I barreled right into that concrete barrier, probably going 50, 60 miles an hour. And I remember, I mean, that the crash was like this freaking thunderbolt. It was so loud. As a matter of fact, I still hear it every once in a while. Like, even when there's a thunderstorm or something, it still freaks me out. And this, like, lightning bolt of pain just shot through my very core. And I remember I opened my eyes, and there was fire and smoke coming out of the hood. It was totally accordioned. I put my hand down to my ankle to try and get it loose because I did see the wall coming and I tried to break and it just snapped my ankle back. So I felt the bones in my ankle. And then my knees hit the, you know, side of the steering wheel and the dash or something, and I completely smashed my pelvis. And this one, I broke my neck at C1, C2, which, by the way, is the same fracture that Christopher Reeve, Superman, sustained. So the fact that I'm, like, standing, a third of the people who sustain that fracture are killed instantly, a third are paralyzed, and a third are brain damaged. And I'm, like, that 1% that's skated. And, I mean, talk about a miracle. So anyway, I just started screaming, Max, Max, we got to get out of here. This car's going to blow. We got to get out of here. And I looked at him, and it looked like he just hit his head and was passed out. But it didn't take too long to realize that he wasn't passed out, that he wasn't breathing, and he was dead. And, oh, my God, I can't even begin to tell you the stuff that was going through my mind. I'll tell you right now, the first thing was, God, please just take me too. There is no way I'm going to be able to live with myself knowing that because of my drinking and driving, a precious life is no longer here. I remember saying all my Catholic schoolgirl prayers, trying to get right with God. My ribs actually punctured one of my lungs, and one of my lungs collapsed. And I'm not kidding you guys, I was on my last breaths. I mean, every breath I took was like, and I was tired. And I was just crushed. I mean, literally and figuratively. And then I saw the blue lights. And I'll never forget, the police officer was just like, Jane, you got to just, you know, keep breathing. We're going to get you out of here. We're going to cut you out. We're waiting for the jaws of life. And, you know, you got to just keep breathing. And I couldn't believe how, and he was petting my hair, like, I couldn't believe how nice he was, because I thought, like, he would have been like, look at what you did, you damn drunk driver, you know. I mean, I just couldn't believe the love that he was showing me. And I'm going to just take a little aside right now and share this, because, it really meant the world to me. But at one of my court hearings down the line, he came up to me and he said, you know, Jane, I just wanted to share that I had a spiritual experience that night like I've never had before. And he said that he was driving down the regular road, and he said it was almost like someone or something tapped him on the shoulder and told him to back up, which he literally did, and went down the old bridge road, which he said he never does. And he said that it was so real that when he saw the crash, it was like he almost wasn't surprised. And I thanked him so much for sharing that with me, because, you know, I was like, why did God leave me here? I mean, if there is a God. And that really made me realize that I definitely was left here for a reason, and now the challenge of my lifetime would be to try and figure out what that reason was, you know? So anyway, I hate talking about this, so I'm going to just cut to the chase. The next thing I remember is being in the hospital. They heliported me to the University of Miami Hospital, and that's where I stayed for a long time. I actually was hospitalized there for 5 months, and then I got let out on my own recognizance to only go to two things: physical therapy, because I had to learn how to do everything again, and to AA meetings. And that's when I first started going to AA. It was in St. Pete Beach, Florida. I went to a 7 a.m. meeting every morning, and let me tell you, you guys saved my life. My parents did the hardcore thing. They did the tough love. It was like they stayed in the hospital with me for like 3 weeks, and then they were like, you're on your own. Your friends have always meant so much to you. Let your friends take care of you. I was like, you mean I can't go up to Jersey? And when I get discharged, they were like, nope. So believe it or not, my roommate in the hospital's family took me in. And again, the kindness of strangers, right? I wouldn't be here without them. And I went to that meeting every morning. I remember them talking to me about step one. Let me tell you something. I knew, laying in that hospital bed for all those months, my life was unmanageable. And I was absolutely powerless over alcohol. Once I started drinking, there was no stopping me, you know. And so I remember my first sponsor telling me, you know, step one is the only one that you have to do perfectly. I was like, I passed that one right out of the gate. I remember they said things to me like, man, Jane, you have got to drop that fierce Irish pride that you have and fall into a place of humility. You know, you need to realize that there's great power in powerlessness. You told me things like, the thing that I took away from step one more than anything else was rigorous honesty, you know. And I committed to that. And I'm telling you, I am the most honest person that you'll ever want to meet. I picked that habit up from the very start. I don't lie. I don't cheat. I mean, I'm from Jersey, so sometimes people say that I'm, like, brutally honest. But I'm telling you, I am honest. That was one commitment I made almost 28 years ago, and I stick to it. So how was I, you know, my attorney was saying, you got to plead not guilty. That road should have been blocked off. I was like, forget it. I am not going to lie, right, like in front of a judge. I'm guilty. I know I'm guilty. I know I'm going to prison. Let's get the show on the road. So that's what I did. I went just to get sentenced. There was no trial or anything. I said, I don't want that. I just want to, you know, plead guilty and get sentenced. And I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation. Now, I can talk about prison for, like, the next hour. but I'll just give you a couple of highlights. First of all, I am so grateful that I got 5 years in prison because that saved my life. I mean, talk about simplifying your life. I lived out of a footlocker for 5 years. You know, and I feel like by simplifying my life, I was able to really find out who I was without alcohol and drugs. And let me tell you, that was a mining expedition because I had no idea who I was without that stuff anymore. I mean, I was always, you know, I was outrageous Jane, you know? I mean, I was fueled by alcohol and drugs. And that's one of the many, many reasons why I'm grateful for the 5 years I got in prison. But I also feel like it gave me an opportunity to not drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection because that would diminish my usefulness to others. And I really learned the value of service work when I was in prison. And that's another thing that I just wanted to emphasize was the value of service work. Oh, my gosh. It saves my life to this day. I'll tell you, talk about humility. My family decided, they must have had a family meeting, they decided to not send me any money the whole time I was in prison. I joke, I'm like, I should have written Orange is the New Black, you know? And I had the greatest experience working on my two biggest character defects, resentments and being judgmental, you know? But my family didn't send me any money. I talk about being humbled. But yeah, writing that new book, I already have the title for it. It's going to be I'm Nobody's Boo because my ass is broke. It was tough. But I'll tell you something. And here's another little side story. I got asked to share my story at a gratitude dinner down in the Florida Keys like a couple of years ago. And the woman who picked me up at the airport worked for the court system, and she worked for the judge that sentenced me. Now, this has been over 20 years. So she told the judge, and the judge came to the gratitude dinner. Isn't that cool? And I was able to hug her, and she cried, and I cried, and she just said, you know, you were one of the hardest sentences that I had to do. And, you know, it was kind of messed up because that same week that I got sentenced to 5 years in prison followed by 10 years of probation, there was an NFL football player that did the exact same thing and got 8 months jail time served, you know. I mean, don't even get me started on our justice system. But yeah, so, but anyway, she said that too. And I just said, you know I would be dead right now if I didn't have that 5 years. So it was kind of a nice full circle moment that I just wanted to share. And okay. Let me get out of prison. Okay, I did my step work in prison. This is where Catholic priests and nuns played such a big part, even in my recovery. I did my fifth step with a Catholic priest when I was in prison. And I'll tell you something, I'm still friends with him to this day, too. And I remember when we sat down, he said, I just want to let you know I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I'm a Catholic priest. I've heard it all. So please be vulnerable. Don't hold back. Tell me everything. And one thing I need for you to know is that you're not okay. I'm not okay. And that's okay. I want you to not only think about forgiveness, but I want you to offer it, but I want you to receive it too. I mean, he said everything that I needed to hear. And I'm telling you, after my step five, that's what marked my return to sanity. I am not kidding. I felt like less of a freak and more of a member of the human race again after I did my fifth step with him. And then some other steps eight and nine, I were also really crucial when I was in prison. I mean, they were all important. I don't have time to talk about them all tonight. But I did them all when I was in prison. But steps eight and nine, man, that's really putting the pedal to the metal. You know what I mean? I got busy. I made my lists. I wrote letters. I'm kind of glad that I did it that way, to tell you the truth. I really took time and wrote really well thought out letters. And I talked about not just the bad stuff, but some of the good stuff too. And that's what my sponsor suggested that I do. And I want to tell this little side story, too. You might be wondering what happened to my boyfriend's family. And I'll tell you, as far as I know, they didn't want to have anything to do with I wrote them a letter. I made my amends. And they chose not to respond. And that really boinged me up for a long time, you know. I never felt free. I just feel like I needed to hear from them. So, the beginning of COVID, I get this email from this dude, and he's like, "Hey, I'm cleaning out my closet, throwing away some newspaper articles and stuff, and Max's mother sent me an article about the accident, and I just want to know if you're the Jane that's in the accident because I Googled you. And if so, I was wondering if I could talk to you. I was Max's roommate in college." And I was like, oh, my God. So anyway, I wrote back and I said, "Yeah, how about tonight? We can talk tonight." And he said, "That would be great. Here's my phone number. P.S. I'm a friend of Bill's." How freaking cool was that? So I was able to actually make a live amends to somebody who knew him. And this was like 25 years later. Can you believe that? Like, so anyway, everything happens in God's time. I mean, 25 years is really stretching it, but I can't tell you how free I felt when I hung up the phone with that guy. And I still can't believe that happened. But the miracles just keep happening, you know? And that's where I'm going to get out of prison and go to my life today, because I see that I just have 15 minutes left. So anyway, I got out of prison, and the miracles just started happening immediately. All those God shots or God winks or coincidences started happening like the day I got out. As a matter of fact, I went to the AA meeting. I'm going to tell you this story because it still freaks me out. I had a hefty bag filled with all my earthly belongings. I got into a taxi cab. And I could not believe the song that was playing on the radio. You know I love rock and roll, right? Well, I started crying. I burst into tears. The cab driver was like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I can't. I just was in prison for 5 years. I can't believe this song is playing on the radio." Well, he turned it up, and we started singing it together. "I'm as free as a bird now." I mean, just crazy. It's like, what are the chances of that? So anyway, dropped my bag off and went to the local AA meeting. And who was at that meeting but the women that brought the meetings into prison? Can you believe that? I had no idea that was where they went to meetings, by the way. They were like, oh, my God, when did you get out? I was like, today. They were like, no way. Oh, my God. And by the way, thank you. If anyone is working corrections, I want to give you a shout out because that's really important work. That was the highlight of my weeks when they came in once a week. And that was the highlight of my week. So thank you if you do corrections work. And if you don't, look into it. They need you. All right. So moving right along. I ended up, now I lost my license for life. I had to go to an AA meeting. Are you ready for this? Now remember, probation for 10 years. I had to go to an AA meeting every day. My probation officer was even like, man, I never heard of that before. I was like, yeah. And I did joke with the judge. I said, I needed that 5 years in prison. But that 10 years of probation, I could have done without. You know, we had a nice little laugh. But I got a bicycle. I mean, by golly, I was not going back to prison, man. I got a bicycle. I cycled everywhere. So I lost my license for life, had to go to an AA meeting every day. So I got an apartment like a block from the AA house in Tallahassee. And I just did what I had to do, man. You know, I got my first job was as a housekeeper in a hotel, worked my way up to the front desk. I had to go to therapy once a month, too. And I got to tell you this story. So therapy was expensive, and I was making minimum wage, right? But I went once a month, and I remember, like, this was the second month that I was out of prison. My therapist said, Jane, we got two carloads of women going to an AA women's retreat. You're coming. Talk to your probation officer. It's in Georgia. You know, it's going to be great. And I was just like, AA meeting? In AA women's convention? Oh, gee, that sounds like a lot of fun. You know, I had no idea that you guys did all this. And the first speaker that I ever saw, I'll never forget, was like this little white-haired woman who got up behind the podium and was talking about how she, you know, was a military mom and she, you know, abused her sons and lived, you know, was a typical alcoholic mom on Valium and this and that. And I was like, damn, that woman's really laying it out. You know, I can't believe the honesty behind that poem. Oh, my God, she doesn't even know anybody here, whatever. Well, that woman today is my mother-in-law. I mean, the hand of God is like in my life before I even knew it. And I didn't meet her son actually until like 15 years later. Isn't that crazy? I know. Polly P. Has anyone heard Polly P? She's my mother-in-law. So I tried to get my teaching certification back and they said, you will never teach again. You're a felon, you know, to give up on that dream, go another route. So I said, all right, well, if I lived when I was really in the throes of despair, I said, if I live through this, I'm going to get a job that is like filled with love and service. So I decided to become a social worker. So any social workers in the house? It's a great job for people in recovery, right? So I ended up randomly on work release in Tallahassee, Florida. That's how I got sent there on work release. I didn't know anybody. And guess what's in Tallahassee, Florida? Florida State University. So I tried to get into the social work program, and I got denied not once because of my felony, not twice because of my felony. Well, yes, twice, but the third time I got in. The third time I got in, and not only did I get in, but I got an assistantship scholarship. And I'll tell you something, I remember looking at that dean and just saying, please, where would any of us be without a second chance? Give me a chance, I will not let you down. And I never let anyone who I made that promise to down. Remember what I told you about honesty and commitment? I take that seriously, and I never let anyone down. And then I started, and I worked full-time at the hotel and then hopped on my bike after my shift at 3 and went to school from 5 until 9. And I did that for 2 years straight. I was like making up for lost time, right? And slowly but surely, I rebuilt my relationship with my family. I always like to mention this, especially like at young people's gatherings. I made good with my financial amends too. I mean, I paid, I can't tell you, that was like the second greatest day of my life after like step 5, was the day I paid off all of my financial amends. I owed my parents $15,000 for the attorney, and I paid that off with interest in 6 years. And I was making minimum wage, you know what I mean? So I suffered, man. I was like living on $15 a week. When people would go out for coffee, I would just, you know, sit there and engage in conversation. I mean, I watched every penny. I felt like I needed to do that. That was just, I mean, I don't judge people who don't do that, but that's how, that was what was inside of me. I had to pay everybody back, and I did. Very proud of it. But, and then I graduated. I got my first job working in a detox. How about that for serendipity? And then I ended up, after a couple of years, becoming the supervisor. And I also had to go through a lot of red tape because of my felony, because those jobs are, a lot of them are state jobs. And again, I went through, I did whatever I needed to do to get waivers and whatever. One of the biggest miracles was in 2008, I got a call from the dean at the College of Social Work asking if I wanted to teach a class. And I was like, heck yeah, what class? Substance use and misuse. I was like, oh yeah, I got that. So I taught, I was an adjunct for 2 years, and then the dean called me again and said, Jane, would you be interested in a full-time faculty position? Now, I mean, talk about miracles. Like, not too many years before, I was sitting on a prison bunk, and then I get asked to be a professor at a major university, you know? So anyway, I just had my third promotion. I've been there since 2008. I'm a teaching professor at Florida State University's College of Social Work. Woo! I'm starting a new position in January. I'm being trained for it now. I'm going to be the Director of International Programs, which is another miracle because, you know, people with felonies have a difficult time traveling, you know. But anyway, they believe in me, and yeah. I actually, no joke, I tried to get into Australia not too long ago, and I could not get in. You know, so that was a bummer, but oh well. I mean, a penal colony, for God's sake, Australia. You're not going to let me in? You're a penal colony. Give me a break. But you know, I was like, whatever. Something better was in store, you know? And I tell you all these things because I don't ever want you to give up on your dreams. And don't put limits on your dreams either. I'm saying this stuff not to boast. I mean, I just want to be an example of somebody who said, you know, hey, man, I'm doing the right thing. I deserve these breaks. You know, I've been doing a lot of service work. I've been staying close to AA. I've been, you know, doing great at whatever job I'm offered. I'm doing the best I can to make all my amends and to live the life that I think God always meant for me to live. Yeah, and when you do that, good things just keep happening. In 2009, I went to the Florida AA State Convention, and I was, you know, it was one of the first big speaking events that I had, and the guy speaker was in from Chicago, and I remember he told his story, and while he was telling his story, I was like, oh my God, me and that guy would have been trouble together. I mean, he loved Led Zeppelin. He dropped out of school, moved to California, became a surfer, ran the streets of Venice, you know, whatever. And I remember going, oh, so anyway, you know how like at the end of the talk, you get up and you, you know, hug the person and say thank you? Well, the person that was in front of me stepped aside. And when I came face to face with this guy, I was like, oh, it took my breath away. I was like, oh my God. I'm going to be with that guy forever. And I had never even cohabitated with a guy, never been married, you know. I mean, I've always been fiercely independent. It was the weirdest thing. it was like, I don't know, call it intuition, whatever. And then I looked down and I saw a wedding ring on his finger. And I was like, oh, I was wrong there. But, of course, we became Facebook friends, right? And I forget what convention. I was speaking at another convention with his mother. And she's like, I'm like, how you doing, Polly? She's like, oh, I just got off the phone with my son, and it's the saddest thing. He is going through the worst divorce ever. And I was like, oh, that's too bad. And, yeah. So anyway, the long and short of it is, he called me. He said his mom lives in Jacksonville, and he said, hey, can I come take you out to lunch? I'm going to be in Jacksonville. And lunch turned into dinner, and we have been on since then. And at the ripe old age of 53, I got married. And let me tell you something. I want to say, like, I don't want you to think that I'm selling into the, oh, a man's going to make me happy and complete. I was totally cool single. Oh, my God, I loved being single, too. But this is a great bonus for this stage in my life. I mean, I have a travel partner, and, you know, and he's so funny. And while we don't have any kids, I have to tell you, I have the most amazing dog that was ever put on the planet Earth. He's a little a-hole. He's a French bulldog, if you know how they're like, you know. But he is the boy of my dreams. I'll tell you, he is the funniest little guy. And anyway, a couple of other things before I close. I told you about my not driving. That is a drag, you know. And a couple of years ago, I got hit by a car. And I also got hit by another biker, and that was really a bad accident. I could have died. And I had my helmet on, too. Wear helmets. Thank God I had my helmet on. And so anyway, my mother has turned into, like, my biggest fan in the world. You know, she went from, like, you know, my husband always loves when I do imitations of my mother. Like when I was in prison and the family didn't send me any money, this is my imitation of her. Oh, you think we're going to send you money so you can buy potato chips and drink Coca-Colas in prison? I don't think so, you know. So the same thing with, when I got out of prison, she was writing to, it was Governor Chris Christie at the time. This is not justice. My daughter's been doing the right thing for all these years. What is she supposed to be driving her bike when she's in her 80s? Come on, this is not right. And she started writing letter after letter after letter. And finally, I guess it got through to his office. On his last night as governor of New Jersey, he called me. I mean, that was 6 o'clock. The phone rings. It's like, hello, Jane. This is Governor Chris Christie. I was like, what? Oh, my God. He goes, let me tell you something. Your mother is something else, you know. I said, yeah. And he said, but I want to tell you something. You make the great state of New Jersey proud. I read everything that you're doing. That 12-step program that you're involved in has saved so many of my loved ones' lives. I'm going to give you a pardon for that first DUI back in 1993. And that opened the door for me to get a hardship license. So I'm finally driving again. And also, this is pretty cool, after 24 years of not being allowed to vote, I just got my voting restoration rights. It was voted on in the state of Florida because we couldn't vote. And finally, I was able to vote in the last presidential election. It was just, thank God. You know, some of my friends are like, why does it mean so much for you to vote? I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, it's like... And plus, look at what women went through to get the right to vote. I mean, come on. But also, it still is like this little message that's continuing to tell you, you're still not worth listening to. You don't have a voice. You know, that same thing that, I don't know, they pound into you when you're a felon, you know. So anyway, that's pretty cool. And also, just all these great things are happening in my life. And, you know, it's not to say bad stuff doesn't happen. I got zapped with breast cancer. That sucked. I also got stalked by a former student, and it was not a love stalking. It was like a dangerous hate stalking thing by this guy who was severely mentally ill. As a matter of fact, he ended up taking his own life. And then a former boyfriend in AA who started to mimic the stuff that guy did because I was dating him while I was being stalked by the first guy. And he is no longer alive either, thank God. And I had nothing to do with either one of them. You know, I mean, because let me tell you, people who have been stalked will laugh at that because it's, it doesn't stop. I prayed that would happen someday, you know. But anyway, I know that sounds terrible, but if stalking is such a, it's a crime that is just minimized way too much. I mean, to live in that kind of fear and to try, thank God for this program because I had the tools to work with that kind of fear, but there were some days that were very, very difficult. So sorry if you think that was in bad taste, but, you know, I think it's whatever. I'm still smiling. Anyway, what else? I just want to leave everybody on a positive note by saying, you know, whatever fear, and this helped me, by the way, during my stalking phase, whatever fear you have inside of you, just know that your higher power is much bigger than that. And your higher power always has your back. Turn it over, turn it over, turn it over. Thy will be done. You know, those are some of my mantras. If you want peace, be peace. You know, don't live in chaos. If it rocks your serenity, walk away. Keep it simple. Those are the things that I really absorbed and I lived by. So anyway, I think that's all that I want to share because we are out of time, right? Yeah. So I hope that everyone has the time of their lives this weekend. I wish you all peace, joy, love. I'll see you out there having a good time on the dancing tables or whatever.